John F. Kennedy Library, President's Office Files, Presidential Recordings Collection, Meeting Recording Number 23. 54 seconds of this tape have been excised for reasons of national security. The three excisions are indicated. For additional information, please see Recording Log Number 23.
there and the problem in Europe. There is an analogy in the sense that we have the problem of deterrence of war out there, just as we have a problem of deterrence in the NATO area. The enemy, however, is different. It's the Red China in one form or another. And the assets of Red China and the weaknesses of Red China are quite different from the assets and weaknesses of the Soviet Union. In the military terms, and this, I looked at it primarily in a military way, I realized the one-eyed aspect of that. The military threat from Red China, of course, is manpower on the ground. They have the largest army in the world. But secondly, and perhaps more critically from our point of view, they also have the fourth largest air force and a pretty good air force. We don't think they fly as well as our China friends, but if you look at the inventory of aircraft that's been built up in recent years, it ends up in quite a formidable threat. So much so that our air people in each one of the areas, say in Korea or in Taiwan or in Southeast Asia, can build a picture with, which is quite graphic and quite realistic, I think, of a 1,000 plane attack, say, against every important target in South Korea in a very short period of time. Now, what we've done over the years is that we have built up in Korea, particularly in Taiwan, very sizable ground forces, but we have lagged in the air defense aspect, so that now we're being hit almost at one time, in a short period of time at least, with the requirements for more advanced interceptors and also for a modernized air control and warning service. So we're having this in South Korea, Taiwan, and also...
Do we have Hawk missiles in...
In Korea.
We
have them planned in Formosa.
Not Hawks yet, but we have a 19 Hercules battery there, or from Danny.
Danny, is that a pretty good depth?
Yes, sir. It's the best up to about 80,000 feet. It's a very, very
as good as the SAM, too.
It's also a surface-to-air missile, Mr. President, something we don't give our credit for, a surface-to-surface missile. A credit we don't give to ourselves, but it has a very good accuracy up to about 90 miles.
It was moved in there at the time of the bombardment of the offshore island in 1958. It's the best missile in the world of its kind.
And this pickup, this could be against an ocean target?
If you could locate the target with sufficient accuracy.
The radar. Do you have a firing, do you have a radar apparatus?
Indeed.
We don't have any Nike's use on Kimoi Matsu, do we?
No missiles, no surface-to-air missiles on Matsu.
Okay. Now, is our number of our missiles on promotion inadequate?
I would say it is inadequate. That is really the point, sir, that the air defense aspect has lagged in terms of other kinds of forces. And unfortunately, when you look at the MAP program, as I told the senator this morning, that's where the money is going. We're planning now to close this gap. But most of the money in the military aid programs are simply for the maintenance of current forces, plus this additional money from the modernization of air defense. That's not entirely true, but generally so. So that's one of the unfortunate things about any serious cut in the aid program out there at this time, is that it does hold back an area in which we are critically weak. Very interesting, I think, important point militarily, Mr. President, is you could go down each country. Take Korea, which is a big money user in that area. I looked that program over, hoping, as I had in previous years, to find some way, from a military point of view, to recommend a reduction. This is a burden which we don't like. It's been looked at year after year. But I would have to report that as long as we keep the present assumptions in Korea, I don't think, from a military point of view, we're justified in reducing our forces. In fact, we should be putting more money, as I've said, into air defense. One of the reasons, however, for that is that the assumption now, the objective given to our forces, the indigenous forces in Korea, is to be able, with South Korean forces, to check and hold off a massive attack mounted not only by the North Koreans, but also by the Red Chinese. In other words, we're setting a very high level of effort as a goal for the indigenous forces. And we're assuming that atomic weapons would not be used. Now, I've discussed this with the Secretary and the Joint Chiefs. I think that we should really come to you and get with a study of an analyzing the pros and cons of the use of atomic weapons in the Far East. Those pros and cons are quite different from the situation in Europe. Sometimes the advantages are greater, sometimes perhaps less. But I think that if we could assume that in case of massive Chinese attack in any part of Asia, whether in Korea or in Southeast Asia, we could certainly recast then some of our military requirements, and I would think reorient some of our programs. So I think that's a capital point that we should bring you a recommendation
on whether we ought to agree to the use of tactical nuclear weapons.
about the pros and cons of the of making that assumption. In other words, if you decide to use nukes sooner, in effect, you're moving your strategy in Asia in the opposite direction to what you are in Europe, and so on. We can all see the pros and cons of that. I merely say I think the studies exist for this kind of examination now. The Joint Chiefs went into it at the same time.
We have to agree. Great detail. If you you are in fact lowering the threshold to the Chinese crossing the river, they're going to use nuclear weapons. And that's quite inconsistent with the policy which we've passed on, and certainly in the European area and generally throughout the world.
Excision 1. 5 seconds excised.
And apply the same terms that you would apply in NATO. The strength that you have there on the ground is going to determine the threshold at which you employ nuclear weapons. Well, I think lower the forces, the sooner you're going to be required to use nuclear weapons.
I think the only thing required now would be to tell us that you would like to have a study that, assuming that we're allowed to plan on the use of nuclear weapons whenever the Chinese come in force into North Korea, then what effect would it have on the force structure? And see what came out of it.
May I say that kind of a study has been made in connection with the fiscal 64 budget. The chiefs haven't had a chance to review it. General Kerry, who's a retired Air Force general, but this ought to be reviewed formally by the chiefs and reported to you. And I asked the chiefs yesterday to
point he was making, Sergei, while you're absent, that this would, in a sense, be the reverse of what we were attempting to do in Europe. But I think the conditions are reversed. In Europe, the reason our strategy as it is because we're faced with nuclear force and a very strong one. In China, we have no nuclear force opposing us. It seems to me this is enough of a difference to warrant at least consideration of a different strategy. And I think whether you say that you use nuclear weapons on crossing, coming into North Korea, which would not be very overt, because they could be coming in and out of there in a peacetime condition, or whether you wait too late to cross the ceasefire line.
Well, the intent would be a massive invasion. If it's not massive, it has no great military significance.
I would think that if they came in mass, the Chinese down, and of course it would be part of it. I would think the more likely thing would be that they would move there, having moved against Quemoy and Matsu, and our having trouble in Berlin. It would be part of a worldwide expansion rather than just a single action there. That's the least likely kind of military action for them to take.
Well, I think that's true, that there's no great feeling that that is a likely contingency now, but the whole situation in Red China can change drastically. If for example, the situation would break in Southeast Asia, we ourselves might want to put pressure on that part of the world.
We're right in an untenable position, I think, at the present time. We're supplying forces which are more than enough to support a strategy based on nuclear weapons, but less than enough to counter a large-scale conventional onslaught. So we don't have any position. And this is why we started these studies, Mr. President.
I would think that the nuclear, you change to using nuclear, I don't know whether it's the Yalu River or whether you say it once they cross the ceasefire line in any force. The reason that we're so slow about using nuclear weapons in Europe is first because we're against nuclear force, and second because of Berlin, where we see that you didn't have the Berlin problem. You just have a clean line, you'd use nuclear weapons almost from the beginning if they came across in force, because that would be a signal for an outfall. Well, we know it isn't going to come that way. It's going to come because of difficulties in Berlin, where we might have to take the first action. So I would think that we could say that you use nuclear weapons. I don't think you could say if they came across the Yalu River, but you could say that we shouldn't use it if they attacked in force across the ceasefire line.
I think that's the point, sir, that we would not be prepared to hold them back by conventional methods if they came in mass. How they got there wouldn't particularly matter.
What would that free? That might free, what, one or two? We got two divisions there.
Well, we got
to
free right
in. The divisions are going to be free, or not the new U.S. divisions. General Taylor, when he was commander of the 8th Army, organized specifically for the requirements of Korea. They aren't very heavy in artillery and transportation, and they aren't very heavy in strength. They're smaller than our division.
So we had two divisions there?
We had two corps, two divisions. The
question is whether they really, that's the place for them to be, is it?
Well, I think it's the greatest deterrent to the resumption of hostilities in Korea.
In our two divisions.
That's right, and I also think that representation of our
such a serious unemployment problem, you couldn't reduce the military force in Korea today without adverse effects on the civilian economy. But in the long run, it would free substantial forces, maybe a couple hundred thousand men. In the long run, it would greatly reduce our military assistance program, because we're supplying air power to Korea and to Taiwan, and we will have to supply it to Thailand if we continue the present policy, which wouldn't be required if we understood that we could use nuclear weapons, particularly nuclear weapons delivered by U.S. aircraft. So I think both of those effects would take place.
The present strength of the armed forces of South Korea, about 600,000, as opposed to about 380,000, I think, in North Korea. So if you really were setting up your military structure in South Korea simply to offset North Korea, manpower-wise, you would certainly think you could make a reduction. But it'd have to go with some arrangement that you wouldn't fear a sudden rush of the Chinese across the Yalu, and that would be the response to nuclear weapons.
The other next place was Japan. Out of your wire, I sent a memorandum to the Secretary of Defense about our capital expenditures in Japan, our dollar expenditures, which I have called it over 350. Really, the limitations that you described, kind of using, if you use Japan, if you really want to use it, it seems to me they probably let you use it with anything.
I think it is a question, sir. I'm afraid my cable, I noticed a state summary, but I didn't think quite the answer. my thought is not that the bases aren't useful, they're very useful. The Navy and the Air Force would say they're virtually indispensable at this time and in time of peace. But if you get into time of war, then it becomes more and more uncertain. And when you look at we have some 680 combat aircraft in the Far East to face the Chinese 2800. About two-thirds of those are on Japanese bases. Now, if we start a war with Red China, it's very likely, as we've indicated here, to be a nuclear war. And whether we could use those two-thirds of Air Force as being neutralized, so to speak, by the Japanese limitation, I don't know, but it's certainly a possibility. But I wouldn't suggest for a moment that we should close up these bases, but they are necessary now, but they're not so important that they should really be the controlling factor in all of foreign policy toward Japan.
Under the present rules, Japan is committed to permit us the use of bases in Japan for the use of our forces against any reassumption of hostilities in Korea. This is a United Nations commitment the Japanese made. They made efforts to evade that commitment when they entered the United Nations, and we were going to move our Far East Command out of there, but when it was put up on the basis that their first action would be to deny the UN the use of Japanese bases as their first act upon joining the United Nations, looked a little bit off key, they withdrew their proposal. Now, the principal objection, the principal handicap at the present time is the question of nuclear weapons in Japan. Japan is emotionally, well, they're fanatical about nuclear weapons for understandable reasons.
Excision 2, 42 seconds excised.
One other broad question, Mr. President, is the proper mix or the proper balance between indigenous forces and our own forces when we consider them packages for military purposes. Years ago, when the military aid program started in the Far East, the thought was that primarily we'd be supported ground forces. We were going to always have a small army. We would need the training of Oriental manpower to help us hold the line in any given sensitive area. Meanwhile, our Navy and our Air Force would utilize their mobility and their striking power and their sophisticated weapons to back up the ground forces, largely indigenous. In the course of the years, that's changed, rather surprisingly. At least I was surprised. To the extent now, we are planning to give sophisticated weapons, advanced interceptors, some naval craft of some sophistication, to these indigenous forces. And I think it's very timely for us to re-examine this whole question of what is the proper mix, what should be the objective of these forces. That really is saying in Pentagon language, to re-examine the map of objectives which we have country by country. In countries such as Korea and Taiwan, for example, we use such broad language as to say these forces are to assist U.S. forces extensively in the event of general war. Well, that is so broad it could mean almost anything. And I personally have the feeling that we should really sharpen our objectives so that they state more specifically what are the common sense, reasonable objectives at this time. That's something for DOD, for the JCS, and states to work out. In Southeast Asia, Mr. President, of course, the threat is quite different. You're impressed always that the subversive insurgency is really have got a great deal of encouragement up here in these young officers. They're keen as they can be. They like what they're doing. They realize the importance of their mission. And none of them would say they had any real difficulties in their personal relationships with the South Vietnamese officers. I asked that question because the press, just shortly before my arrival, carried some such statement. And I would say, based upon my observations and many discussions, it just isn't so. How are we doing there? Of course, I'd read the reports, as all of us have, over the last 10 or 11 months, but really, it's just to be on the ground in a sense. I lived in the national morale. It was right on the ground last October when I was there. The Hamlet program is indicative, I would think, of the greater public popular support. They have either fortified or enforced their fortifications, some 5,000 Hamlets out of the total 16,000. This is done very largely by voluntary work on the part of the local people with very little government guidance. It's getting some, but the program really ran away from the government plan. Also, it's something to see the over 100,000 mountaineers, the Montagnards, who come out of the mountains, left their fields, left the area in which they want to live in order to escape communism.
Excision 3, 7 seconds excised.
Cleaning up the villages, getting adequate defenses for them, and also bringing in a new, improved agricultural method so that their whole life of the Montagnard, for the first time, is showing some kind of promise.
We saw the minister this morning. He discussed with us this question of using pesticides against their food, and I told him to give them an answer one way or another by the end of the week. They wanted to try some test runs up in the areas which are clearly Viet Cong.
They're very active.
All the pluses and the minuses about it. What's our judgment about it? I thought we ought to answer them one way or the other.
Well, this has been talked back and forth between the state and defense for some time, and the local people are unanimous in saying this rather modest initial effort should be tried.
How about Hawkins, for instance?
He called for it. Also, Yemen for it.
Can they tell, they think, which are which?
Arguing against on this ground. I do point out that there is this thing. against it, and that this will not be depriving the Viet Cong of available food.
Well, couldn't we have there seems to have to be some proposal made that food would be supplied to these areas by the government. Then the government would be able to distribute.
Once they get answered, but at this time these are closed areas. Don't know.
Part of the problem is if you destroy the crops and mow down the yards come out, then being prepared to take care of them when they do come out. Well, now this is fairly well along the resolution as I understand it.
This we have a program to do.
Yes, that's
how people have been through it in China and elsewhere. I think that the law school far loss of goodwill among the peasants will far outweigh such relatively small gain in taking away the food from the Viet Cong. That's the amount of judgment which all people are very strong for, I'm sure.
Who's that because?
Huh?
Who are those people?
Well, Rice, who has been through it in China and seen what happened when you prejudice the peasants against you. And he thinks the whole thing's going to be won on the basis of whether the peasants are with you or not. Come and destroy their crops. It builds up an antagonism which is very heartbreaking.
I think Roger Hillsman's theory on this is somewhat similar for what it's worth. It's mainly that if you can identify the enemy very precisely and be sure that you're not getting possibly friendly peasants hurt too, then it's good to do if it can be done in a rather large scale, because then you really want to get real military advantage commensurate with the political risk. There's some worry that doing it just in a few very small areas, we might take an awful political whacking and not really get
a
big military job done.
And then it makes the local population ready to join the Viet Cong and change the whole atmosphere.
Well, this is just another form of bombing. I think it's the same problem.
It's a very strong political argument against it among people who have had experience in this.
Well, why don't we, without putting an impossible burden on them, why don't we say that we are now leaning or inclining towards permitting this program, and then we would like to first, is there sufficient time to make it effective? Number two, can it be done on a wide enough scale and yet with accuracy to make it worthwhile? And three, what is the technique they're going to use to detect? What areas they're going to do, and what is the system they're going to use to determine what is the Viet Cong, what isn't, and then what procedure they make to take care adequately of the people who are not Viet Cong, but who are damaged or find themselves short of food. And then if we get an answer back in 48 hours or so, then we make a final judgment on it. Try to tell them, we'll give them a final answer when we get back. Maybe some other questions we ought to ask them.
Those are the principal ones.
Well, then we ought to try to tell them, we'll give them a final answer by the weekend. I'm sure they want to screw around tomorrow.
One of the things, Mr. President, we need to look at a little more greater attention is the best method of reporting our progress. In other words, how are we doing? We're always asking ourselves that, and we have never had a very good way to answer it, except by steel. I found that General Harkins has anticipated this to a certain degree, and now puts out a questionnaire, a rather heavy questionnaire, to all the military people in the field, so that once a month they report back indicators, such as ability to go in certain villages where they hadn't been before, and so on. My comment to the ambassador was that I think I thought that this should be a country team affair, so that all the questions, the political questions, don't get injected into the same kind of questionnaire, and that once a month we get a complete poll across the board in those areas that we understand.
But you know, we suggest to the ambassador, and I think he's accepted it, that we send a group of Vietnamese speaking officers, foreign service officers, out to station one in each of these important areas to maintain contact with the many people, to maintain contact with the local officials and the people, and try to be eyes and ears of the ambassador and the country team to help answer this question. This would be supplementary.
All of these things should be done, but now we have literally hundreds of Americans all through Vietnam who are qualified observers, and they should be passing in without
the report. That's great. And it's a problem of getting the information in front of them, really. They're all busy people.
Three are being established outside of Saigon, and they will serve as sort of vacuum cleaners to pick this stuff up.
Yes.
Elsewhere in the Southeast Asia, Mr. President, I stopped in Cambodia and had the first impact of the CNN's personality. He could have been nicer. I told him that. I don't know why he comes with this man. Thailand and Cambodia, we have a real problem of emotionalism on the question
like
of
India
the border.
Sir? It's like India and Pakistan.
Yes, and perhaps even more so right now. Sihanouk is a wild man, as you know, and he really believes that both of his neighbors on the right and left are his enemies, mortal enemies, historical enemies, and these invasions are just feeling him out that someday he'll come over and stay. And he believes that. I don't think there's anything phony about it. And then you get over and talk to Surrett, and he is, of course, a wise old crow and a tough old cookie, but he gives us a pretty good beating now, and he really doesn't mean it. He smiles when he calls us these names, but he has behind him his people worried about Cambodia because of the very modest military aid. They're painting the picture of attacks by Cambodia. I said, I had more confidence in the Thai armed forces than Surrett did, and he really thought that was a possibility.
How much are we giving them in our aid program?
The real issue now is not the basic Cambodian program, but a little increment which represented the equipment for three infantry battalions and one so-called frontier battalion, which Sihanouk would undertake to put in the northeast frontier to help stop the infiltration, something we're all for. It makes all the sense in the world. And now that we've had to pay this price in entire relations, I would say we ought to go ahead and do it. It's about 1.7 million, as I recall, from doing it.
A part of this problem, Mr. President, is also a problem of diplomacy here, if you will, the problem of the Thais reading this in the newspapers. First, anything that comes out in Phnom Penh leaks, and it leaks to the Thais through the newspapers instead of our being able to tell them directly. To the degree that we can tell the Thai about these, Laos, our own people, we always used to
started a civic action program in the armed forces, very much along the model which we had in Korea, one which I think should have long-term benefit. Of course, the whole country is burdened and will be burdened for an indefinite number of years in the future by the saddle of debt of the Soviet Union. As you know, they have received credits and actually drawn down credits to almost $1 billion in military equipment. They have some $500 million in economic credits. How far they've been drawn down, I don't know. But you really can visualize a country with a mortgage for the indefinite future to the Soviet. Yet, on the military side, the military men now regretting it, saying, yes, of course, we thought we were going to war with over West Syria. Now we'd like to turn back. We'd like to give back some of this equipment and come and turn to the West. But they can't do it. My own feeling is we should give some aid to Indonesia, a small amount. They don't, in the military field, they need very little, LSPs, things of that sort, plus some support for this civic action program, which really, I think, holds real promise, largely in the political field.
We got any Indonesian officers training here? Or
yes, sir, we've always had. That program has never stopped. We ought to give them just as many spaces as they can use.
This was reviewed by, you were there, April, I think, in New York with the secretary and Sabandio.
Yes, I had a number of lunch now, 3 hours with him. He made it very plain that they wanted to get out from under the Russian influence. It's going to be a tough thing to do until they get this money paid off.
Yeah, it'll be a long time.
But I think we ought to continue. We ought to give them, I told them, I thought we ought to give them preliminary assistance and then study out their program, but they'll have to work something out with the IMF, and they're not very keen to do it, and I think we ought to hold back a longer range program until they develop the program which the IMF approves. But in the meantime, I'm giving them that. My industry is down 30% something. Give them a little of the spare parts and raw materials, which will help them on base. Indicate that we're ready to help them when they put their house in order.
The great purpose of this build up was West Syria, was it?
Yes, sir. Have they delivered? Most of it's either delivered or in the pipeline. Apparently, Sukarno and Khrushchev got together and agreed they'd put all the steam into this thing they could, and they really, really have accomplished it. I asked could they cancel or turn back anything, and they said most of the high money value articles have been delivered or on the way.
Are they pleased there was a peaceful settlement in West Syria, or are they pleased there was a peaceful settlement?
Very, very happy about it. Very happy about our activities.
How much did we ever find out how much the Dutch put in there as far as troops? 5,000 was it? I noticed a story of Marcus Charles yesterday about all that.
They were building up to 10,000, but I don't think they ever got to that. Around 6,000 or 7,000.
That's all they put in to the old West Indies.
I'm sure. I don't think they ever got higher than that.
It was very low. What do the Indonesians have under arms, do you know?
Well, they have 350,000 now under arms, but I don't think they got about 1,200 men into the island.
They infiltrated about 2,000 into West Syria.
I think we've got it in around 12 months.
Well, those are principal points, Mr. President.
What about we were going to talk about whether we withdraw, what we do about the withdrawal of the MAG from Laos?
Sir, we're having a meeting for you on that on Friday, if you if that would be all right with you. We haven't quite gotten that the program.
I think we were waiting on the agency and get an estimate, round up all the intelligence material so we have the latest agreed statement of what's happening. That's due, as I understand it, Thursday. Have a meeting yet.
I talked to the minister, I guess you may, on this question of this morning, the 2 a.m., on this question of the minister, to wait and see what they do on that.
South Vietnam representation.
South Vietnam representation, yes.
They seem to be
drawing back slightly on that.
Yes, there's hope. There's basically hope in the cable.
Okay.
First, I'm reporting to you that we met with President Ayub this morning for an hour and a quarter on the MAC program.
He had a lot to take up with you. We said yes and no at the appropriate places. We gave firm answers. He said he'd rather have no. Maybe, so we gave no in places where it seemed suitable, and we broke up on, I thought, very friendly terms. And
went out of the day.
And McConaughey has since reported to me that I was pleased with the results. We didn't increase
told him that, and we have a plan.